This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. Lukaku-less Chelsea take a big step towards the last eight of the Champions League. Havertz leads the line. Kante is peak Kante. And who's this young winger shipped over from the USA? Why have we never spoken of him before? Also, we know the first minute is a terrible time to score, but it really is if you're Juve managed by Max Allegri. Villarreal come back and perhaps deserve more than a draw, while Rabiot. In things more important than football, but in a footballing context, what will World War III mean for the location of the Champions League final, and have Roman Abramovich's assets been stolen? In which case, what does that mean? Also today, an extended Fit Bar corner, Ewan Murray from the Jazz Bar, Rangers' extraordinary win in Dortmund, Celtic's title charge, and there's some good football social media content. Your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Barry Glendenning, welcome.
Hi, Max.
Hello, Nicky Bandini.
Morning.
And hello, Jonathan Faduba. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you.
All right, let's start at Stamford Bridge. AB says, given the pod's clear anti-American bias, are Chelsea heading into the second leg clinging to a 1-0 lead? Chris says, as an American, I require the podcast to be solely dedicated to the greatest soccer player in the world and only discussing Christian Pulisic's goal in the Champions League today. Jonathan, he had a brilliant game, didn't he?
Yeah, he had a pretty good game. He was effective. I think that he, you know, obviously himself and Ziyech, I thought were pretty good. Obviously Ziyech got the injury, but still, Pulisic, you know, for the all-star American that he is, I thought he was quite good. You know, his pass success was very high. Created two chances, got a really nice goal. Did a really nice jig after his goal. Nice little dance. So all in all, it was a good night for him and a good night for Chelsea. I thought they were a lot more fluid, you know, without wanting to get on Romelu Lukaku's back. They were a lot more fluid without him, with Havertz up front, just allowed them to be, Havertz sort of to withdraw a little bit and them to interlink off each other quite well. There's been a lot of talk about touches, hasn't there? And Havertz had, I think, 47 touches in this game. So, you know, compared to the 7 of Lukaku's at the weekend. So I guess that was the big kind of talking point around the game. But Pulisic, you know, he was effective. I thought Thiago Silva was excellent as well at the back. Just for someone at his age, his positioning and his awareness is just so good, as you might expect given the experience. But his all-round game is just such a high level still, even despite his years. And Kante in the middle was as effective as ever, got a really nice assist for the Pulisic goal. So it was sort of got a job well done for Chelsea, to be honest. I didn't think Lille really troubled them that much. They came into the game a little bit more, but after quite a nervous start. But all in all, it was a pretty decent night's work for Chelsea. I think the only real problem, I guess, for them ahead of the final that they've got the weekend is Kovacic and Ziyech both went off injured. So that's a slight concern for them. But apart from that, I think it was a pretty decent night's work.
We're now, aren't we? We're going to have to live with counting how many times Romelu Lukaku touches the ball, or whoever is playing up front for Chelsea passes the ball, touches the ball for the rest of the season or the rest of time, aren't they? You know, Keshav says, with Havertz scoring from his eighth touch and Lukaku only having 7 during the weekend, would one more touch have resulted in a goal? He says, Dan says, is Kai Havertz taking the mickey with his 23 touches in the first half? But as you said, Jonathan, they do look more fluid. And it was interesting last night, Nicky, that they started putting the ball in the box much more. They almost played. It was almost like Tuchel was completely trolling Lukaku by playing a system and playing a way that would have suited him much better than the last game.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's this sort of fascinating conundrum about why things, not even why they're not working, like why they're not working to this extent with Lukaku, because that is such an extraordinary thing, that the 7 touches is why we're still talking about it days later. It's so sort of, it's such an outlandish number, especially when one of those touches was literally the kickoff. And I can't give you sort of a real sort of footballing reason why he would be that much not involved. You know, he wasn't someone who was completely static at Inter. He hasn't been that player for the last 2 years. In fact, one of the great narratives at Inter was Antonio Conte has helped him to lose weight and he's lighter on his feet and he moves more than he used to. And there's got to be something more to it than just tactics when you've got someone who's that sort of I guess, separated from what the whole team's doing. But certainly the performance last night was something very, very different. Certainly Havertz looked like a man who was very eager to take advantage of this opportunity. And, you know, I've seen it posited this morning that even perhaps in some regard, this sort of story with Lukaku can lighten the load on him in some way, because he's come in himself as a striker who, with all the bonuses attached, could cost Chelsea about 90 million euros. And suddenly no one thinks about the fact that he actually he's been injured a lot, but he hasn't scored many times this season. He hasn't necessarily been consistent in that scoring role. Partly, of course, because he also scored in a Champions League final, which will get you a lot of credit for a long time. But I think in some ways it's sort of the psychological part of this is part of the story as well. And I think that Lukaku's sort of mindset at this moment is fascinating. After an interview he gave to Sky Italia, which of course ruffled a lot of feathers and really sounded like a player who was regretting his decision to move at all. And the psychological part of it might also be a benefit in a weird way to Havertz, who can come into the situation now with far less pressure than might have been on him if there wasn't this other player who's taking away from that in some way.
Barry, a tricky one for you. N'Golo Kante is good, isn't he?
yes, he is. Thomas Tuchel ordered him after the game, and rightfully so. I mean, I suppose his best moment was when he picked up the ball, you know, inside his own half and just charged forward with a trail of Lille players in his wake and played the ball wide for Pulisic, whose finish was delightful, a nice little dink, curl dink inside the power post. But you've stitched me up again, Mac. I can't think of anything new to say about Kante.
No, it's hard to think of something new, but there is something quite amazing about it's almost like you forget. I sometimes forget that this guy's talent is so immense. And that he's so everywhere, and he is sometimes on days like this, he's like worth an extra player. There is an interesting question from Nathan, even if I didn't ask an interesting question, which is to whom it may concern. I remember when everyone was constantly analysing Maurizio Sarri's decision to have Kante pushed up in a midfield three, yet Tuchel has put Loftus-Cheek in the holding role and kept Kante pushed up, and no one bats an eye. Is it possible that Sarri was actually right all along and people should be more grateful he forced Kante higher up, thus making him more versatile and ideal for the high press? I think Chelsea fans owe a decent sum of their success to Sarri ball. Would anybody like to contest that one? Barry?
Well, I wouldn't disagree with that. I mean, I was a big Sarri fan and still am. He wasn't perfect, but I think Chelsea fans just never warmed to him and didn't like him. I don't know if that's because, you know, he looked like a bit of a slob and he chain smoked fags and licked nicotine patches on the sideline.
What a surprise you like him, Barry.
But, yeah, for whatever reason, maybe because he didn't look like a footballer, Chelsea fans didn't warm to him, and so any decision he made, they didn't like. You know, many of them thought Jorginho was a complete waste of time and were upset with Sarri's apparent obsession with him. But, you know, Sarri is long gone. Jorginho's still there and he's still a key, excellent player for Chelsea. So I think much of the criticism levelled at Sarri by Chelsea fans was very unfair. And any decisions he made were going to be met with raised eyebrows and abuse, even if they were the correct decisions.
It's funny, isn't it, with Sarri, because he's this sort of the manager who came from a non-footballing background, who was working in a bank, and I think that the sort of the famous sort of example of that in I guess modern football history, Arrigo Sacchi was the man who didn't come from football and was a great manager, but he had a certain slickness to him. He sort of managed to sort of carry up looking very professional, whereas Sarri, I mean, he doesn't look like someone who worked in a bank a lot of the time, does he? He looks like someone who's just sort of strolled in from, I mean, you know, I want to use the word bar, but I mean an Italian bar where it's a coffee shop as well. But he's sort of come in from there, he's been smoking outside and he's wearing whatever he threw on that morning. And
I mean, sorry, Nicky, I could go down to my local William Hill and there'd be 15 Maurizio Sarris in there, either standing outside smoking or inside filling out lucky 15 slips or back in Greyhounds, you know.
But I agree with Barry that I think he's going to be forever judged differently because of that. I think the way that he carries himself will cause people to remember him differently everywhere. But I mean, I think he's, even now, he's a slightly confounding figure, because at Lazio this season there's been ups and downs for him. But some of the things he does tactically have been really brilliant. Like, he's getting the most of the moment out of a player called Mattia Zaccagni, and it's really exciting. But it's, I think his Chelsea job, we can say, was incomplete. I think he wasn't perfect. It's not like Conte who won the league there. You know, he won the Europa League. But he did do some things. He has got some tactical chops. And I think, again, without wanting to always sort of have to tie into that story, you know, you don't get to that spot of managing Chelsea when you were working in a bank in your 40s unless you do have some clever ideas along the way.
Jonathan, do you think the centre forward position at Chelsea, sort of post Drogba, is some kind of sort of poisoned position? I don't know if I've got the timeline right, but I think of the number of players that have tried to be that player. You know, Timo Werner's had stick, Lukaku obviously, Havertz hasn't. You know, it's coming good now, and these are quite recent, but like Fernando Torres, I sense there's a really long list of centre forwards in between that I've forgotten, but I can't think of anyone who's been like a huge success. It doesn't seem to matter because Chelsea just win some trophies all the time and then just get rid of whichever centre forward is, you know, not good enough or surplus to requirements. But I just wonder if that position just, it feels to me like it's a difficult one to fill.
Yeah, I mean, even Kai Havertz hasn't necessarily been prolific since he joined. I know he's not an out-and-out striker. He's more of a sort of a withdrawal and maybe false nine type role. But you're right. I mean, when you look at it, there's been Shevchenko over the years, hasn't there? There's been Torres. Diego Costa is probably one of the ones that you could maybe argue was a success.
Yeah, Morata didn't work either, did he?
Yeah, Morata didn't work. So there's always been that issue with Chelsea strikers, and that's something that Tuchel alluded to in his press conference before the game. He said that, you know, this isn't necessarily a Lukaku problem. It's sometimes Chelsea's actual style of play, and I think he mentioned the word defensive a bit in how they approach games, and that doesn't necessarily allude to helping a striker like Lukaku. I find it a bit of a weird. I think there's two sides of it, to be honest, with Lukaku. I think the first one is he's a bit unlucky in the fact that Chilwell and James have been injured, and they're such creative outlets for Chelsea, for a striker, because they provide a lot of the width and the crosses and creativity. The replacements for them aren't quite at the same level, the likes of Alonso. And I think Lukaku enjoyed that at the start of the season and then has dipped. There's also been the talk of mental tiredness. You know, Tuchel mentioned after the game that he's maybe mentally fatigued, and Lukaku didn't even get off the bench in this game. So, you know, there is that side of it. And I think this is one of those cases where Lukaku's not really helped himself with the comments that came out, obviously. I think you can argue that, you know, it wasn't the right thing to do. You can say that, you know, maybe he's just given an opinion. You know, footballers are people and entitled to give an opinion. At the end of the day, it was Italian TV. He was trying to maybe express how much he loves Inter rather than downbeat Chelsea. But at the same time, it wasn't very well advised. And that's kind of played into this whole thing, hasn't it, really? Like, why there's people getting on his back. But I think there is a case to argue that, you know, the style of play that Chelsea play isn't really necessarily suited to his game. If you look at how Conte used him at Inter, he was more of a kind of, you know, counter-attacking style. I think, you know, when we looked at how Harry Kane did against Man City, that was kind of the role Lukaku was playing. You know, everyone was praising Kane for how well he did. That was the role that Lukaku was kind of playing under Conte, if you know what I mean, when he was at Inter. So that kind of come deep, lay it off, and then make runs into the box kind of thing. And that's what Lukaku was so good at when he was at Inter Milan, and what made him so successful. So it is a strange one with Chelsea strikers. But I do also think that, you know, with the Euros and everything like that, sometimes players just, there's been so much football over the last 2 years that sometimes that just happens. And all that's just created a perfect storm, really, where maybe Lukaku at the moment is just not on it. But, you know, you could easily see him going and scoring a couple of goals in the cup final, for example, on
100%,
Sunday.
He's not that.
But he's not a bad player.
I don't call Conte a counter-attacking manager. He's already had a go at Guardiola this week about that. I think it's a really sort of interesting point as well about Lukaku, because I sort of went straight to that sort of interview as well with sort of the mind state of a player and getting that few touches. But it's also worth saying that I think what Jonathan just sort of hinted at the end there, just because he didn't start this game doesn't mean that's forever. And I think when you look at the specifics of this game, which maybe we haven't done enough, like that the fact is that Lille have got two quite slow centre-backs, and so it makes sense as a tactical choice to go with the lighter, faster attack than to go with the heavier one. Because Joao Font and Sven Botman, and Botman's actually a really promising young defender. He's someone who I know was a Newcastle target in January, but also Milan were interested in him. But they're both quite heavy-footed. Neither of them is quick. And I think that part of it, we all sort of look at, oh, seven touches, that's the whole story. That part of it is also part of the manager's consideration of the lineup he sends out and why Havertz was able to be effective in that game.
You don't become a bad player overnight, or I suspect someone one day has. If you could let us know, if there was a player who did literally become bad overnight, we'd love to hear about it. Michael says, does the ridiculous dance performed by Christian Pulisic after his goal mean that serious thought has to be given to removing the Pulisic watch feature and going back to presenting he doesn't exist? Barry, are you aware of the griddy dance?
No, I this has been mentioned already. I'm not aware of it.
I mean, you seem to sort of do a little, it's hard to sound like a middle-aged man, but do a little shuffle. You bring your fingers up to your eyes, a bit like when you were at school calling someone a geek because they wore glasses, which I appreciate when I'm looking at three people wearing glasses is offensive, and I apologise. But, you know, you do that and then you move your arms back. Anyway, unless anybody else knows about the griddy dance, is anybody else across it? You're young. Jonathan, Nicky, you like American football. You know, maybe it's it was originally. I'm sorry, I put you in the same bracket as us, Nicky, in generational terms. Originally invented by Louisiana's Alan Davis, a friend of the former LSU wide receiver Jamar Chase, who wanted to create his own rhythmic dance after he was inspired by the Nene craze in the mid 2010s. I must confess that the Nene craze passed me by. You know, I'm a late adopter of things, so I'm very happy to get into the Nene craze. People think it's a good idea. I very much hope that what I have just said isn't terribly offensive in some way. But back to Lille, Jonathan. It was nice to see Hassan Ben Arfa. I thought you sort of remember what a wonderful footballer Ben Arfa was in sort of with little touches, a bit like he was at Newcastle, right? He wasn't great all the time, but you can see the guy's got talent. And Renato Sanches as well is clearly a brilliant footballer.
Yeah, they've got some good players, Lille. I mean, let's not forget they're the reigning French champions. It hasn't worked out for them this season. They're not doing so well in Liga either. They're sort of mid-table. Part of the reason for that is they've lost their manager, Christophe Galtier, who went to Nice. So, Justin Gourvenec came in and he said, funnily enough, we're talking about Kante. He said after the game that they had a tactic to try and foul Kante, so that didn't go too well with the goal. I think they were he mentioned that they wanted to try and restrain him and bring him down. But I don't think this tie is over necessarily. Obviously, away goals has been scrapped. I still think that Lille have a chance to get back into it. Didn't see too much of Jonathan David in the game. He's a really promising young talent as well that a lot of people are looking at in the Premier League, the striker. Renato Sanches is improving all the time. And yeah, Ben Arfa, as you mentioned, he had a little sort of few touches and a decent cameo. He's still got a bit to offer. I still think Chelsea will go through, but Lille aren't totally out of it, in my opinion. I still think they can pull off an upset if they're on, top form, if they hit the right notes on the day. But you'd say that Chelsea have probably got one foot in the next round.
Right, that'll do for part one. Part two will begin at the Estadio della Ceramica in Villarreal. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Villarreal 1, Juventus 1. Our first ever meeting between these two sides. Vlahovic scored after 32 seconds on his Champions League debut. Nicky, you and I were working on the game together, sort of established this is a bad time for Juve to score, perhaps.
It depends on your perspective. I think I was saying on the broadcast, Juventus Twitter was awash with memes of Max Allegri's face when he's told he gets to defend a 1-0 lead for 90 minutes. And that is his sort of footballing ideal, it feels like. Unfortunately, Juventus weren't good enough to see it through. Wonderful. I don't know where you want to start on this. I mean, wonderful goal from Vlahovic. And, sure. And I think you couldn't ask for, and you literally can't, because I think he's the fastest, possibly since in the Champions League era, the fastest debut starting goal scorer ever. I think I saw someone saying that someone scored one faster off the bench, but he was the fastest from the beginning to do it. Apologies if that statistic turns out not to be correct. It's what I've heard. Either way, it's 32 seconds, 33 seconds. And, you know, on his weaker foot, and I think showed you, as we were talking about last night, it was everything that Juventus wanted from him. It's the thing that they've been missing as a team up front is a striker who just wants to score goals, who wants that to be their job and who wants to be attacking the area like that, making that sharp run. Lovely pass from Danilo as well, by the way. Really, really nice pass. But just making that angled run into the box and having the instinct to chest it and then hit it first time across your body with your weaker foot and still find the bottom corner. I thought it was an incredible start and really thrilling for it as well, because this is one of those players who we've been watching in Italy for a while, becoming something, who's been at Fiorentina, being this sort of, you know, 20 and then 21 and matching Cristiano Ronaldo's calendar year goal scoring record with 33 goals in a calendar year at Fiorentina. And was he going to be able to make this step up to the Champions League? And you can't get a more emphatic answer than that. Actually, one thing we didn't talk about last night, Max, which I think is sort of fun, is, you know, Lukaku comes into this sort of midweek session. Everyone talks about Lukaku's had 7 touches in a game. Actually, because Vlahovic had his worst game so far for Juventus last weekend against Torino. He was basically shut out of it by Bremer. It was a really well-played game by Torino. And he had 22 touches. And all of the Italian papers were, only 22 touches. This is your 75 million euro man. Which, you know, 3 times Lukaku. But funnily enough, last night he had 24 touches, but one of them was a goal, and another one he had in the, I can't remember when, the last 5 minutes, was another really good attempt in a game where Juventus generated almost nothing. He had another turn and shot from the edge of the area that required a really good save. So he's special. The fear is his specialness only allows Max Allegri to go even more into this mode that he can do, I think, at his worst, which is, I've got someone brilliant who'll score goals for us, which means I don't need the rest of the team to do anything except keep things tight.
Barry, you did the minute by minute of this game. Would you agree that Villarreal certainly deserves at least a draw out of it, given their second half performance?
I think they deserved a draw. I wouldn't say they deserved any more. I was a bit perplexed when you suggested in your intro, I think, that maybe they should have won.
Oh, I'll change the intro now.
For much of the game, I thought they were very slow and ponderous approaching half time. They looked completely out of ideas. And I was expecting changes from Unai Emery. And he didn't make any at half time, which kind of surprised me, because they just looked like they didn't know what to do. They were playing into Juve's hands, and then Juve were in complete control of the game at 1-0 up and started rocking a bit and then conceded this goal, letting Dani Parejo ghost from midfield into the penalty area completely unmarked to score with a nice little finish. But yeah, I think a draw was a fair result. It was a fairly entertaining game. I cannot see either of these teams getting past the next round, I would say. I would be very surprised if either progressed. One thing about Villarreal, it just looked like a sort of semi-retirement home for old Premier League names like Juan Foyth, Alberto Moreno, whose mistake led to Juve's goal, Giovanni Lo Celso, Etienne Capoue, Arnaud Danjuma, you know, so all these names. Like, oh yeah, God, he used to be at Watford, he used to be at Spurs. Villarreal, I expected more from them, I have to say. I don't think they deserve to win, but a draw was fair.
I really agree with Max. With Baz, by the way. I when you said that in the intro, I was like, I don't think they created enough to deserve to win. They had a couple of chances.
That's not going in the intro now. You both said it. You know.
I suppose the other sort of player. I mean, there's two other things that I sort of feel like are important to mention in this game. One is Adrian Rabiot, who was just catastrophically didn't mark Parejo for that run. Although, having said that, it wasn't like the rest of the Juventus defence that like they knew where they were, because Bonucci had come on in the second half for Alexandro, because Alexandro starts in a back three and you think, well, he's not really a centre-back. Bonucci comes on in the second half actually because of injury to Sandro. He is just back from injury, but this bizarre situation on the Villarreal goal where it's Bonucci and De Ligt and a third Juventus defender all marking one player and none of them tracking the run of Parejo, who's also been dropped by Rabiot. Rabiot then should have been sent off. And I think that is something that I sort of didn't want to sort of miss from the game. Absolutely sort of horrible studs up challenge. VAR somehow didn't intervene on. And I know you were sort of quite shocked by that last night as well, Max. I thought that was a really horrible moment.
Yeah, I can't believe that VAR. I mean, I don't know what you think, Barry, but I it is tedious to talk about referees and VAR and what they're there to do. But how can anybody see that challenge and not go, mate, have a watch again? Because he's jumped into him with his studs sort of around just below the kneecap. It is a disgusting challenge, isn't it?
Yeah, he should have gone, no question. And I was baffled by the non-intervention of VAR. You could forgive the ref, German fellow Daniel Siebert, who is a decent ref, for maybe missing it, but certainly his attention should have been drawn to what had happened. He should have gone and had a look. And it was a horrible tackle on Samuel Chukwueze, who was one of Villarreal's better players. While we're lauding Americans, I have to say that yesterday evening, I haven't seen a huge amount of him. It was the first time I've ever seen Weston McKennie play well, have a good game. I thought he was very impressive in midfield for Juventus, but he was forced off with what I thought was a sprained ankle, but it turns out he's fractured two metatarsals and will be out for, I don't know, however long, a week longer than Kieran Trippier.
Yeah, it's quite a big concern, I think, for the US men's national team, because they've got some quite big qualifiers coming up in March and a very real chance that he misses those now. Funnily enough, as someone who does watch McKennie more, I've sort of think he's been on quite a nice progression recently. When I first saw him at Juventus, he was very quickly very hyped, as happens with American players when they come to Europe. And I thought he was an interesting sort of high energy player, but a bit of a sort of... sometimes could seem a bit like the kid in the playground, right? You know, he's charging everywhere and he's getting involved in everything, but is he controlled enough? Like, he was great when the game broke down, but did he fit in a tactical sort of system? I think in the last couple of months, he really has been playing at a higher level and looking more like someone who's taking another step in his career. And I think it's really unfortunate timing for Juventus and the US national team, because he might be the best performing midfielder Juventus have got right now. So it's definitely not good for them going into the next round of the Champions League. And they're the second leg of this game.
Azanda says, with Philippe not there, can you ask Barry to say Rabiot, 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 Rabiot? People remember Philippe getting very exercised during the Euros about Adrien Rabiot. It's okay. I, of course, got in touch with Philippe Auclair and he sends us this message.
There are questions which probably are not worth asking. Why is the sky blue, at least it is today? Why is the sea salty? Why is Rabiot Rabiot? And there is probably an explanation somewhere, some very clever people who can explain to you why the sky is blue today and the sea is salty and Rabiot is Rabiot. But ultimately, it all comes down to the same thing, is that, you know, the sea is salty, the sky is blue, and Rabiot is Rabiot, and Rabiot will always be Rabiot, and he's always been Rabiot. And you cannot ask Rabiot not to be Rabiot, so expect him to carry on being Rabiot, and don't be surprised anymore. The sea is salty, Rabiot is Rabiot.
Oh, I mean, sometimes I think I love Philippe Auclair more than anything else.
Oh my God. Doesn't he make
wonderful man?
Doesn't he make? I know he makes. Philippe makes music. He needs to turn that into a music track somehow.
There we go. Liam McClare makes loops of this podcast, the musician. And so if you are listening to this, can you make a Rabiot is Rabiot, the sea is salty loop, please? Jonathan, who's your money on to go through?
Juventus. I think Juventus will go through. To be honest, obviously I didn't see the game, so I was watching Chelsea. But in the group stages, they didn't massively impress me, to be honest. So a bit like what Barry was saying, they kind of got a hodgepodge of kind of former Premier League cameo appearance players who at times did quite well. I remember one of the Manchester United games, Capoue, put on a decent performance. But yeah, I think they've done quite well to get this far. To be honest, I thought Atalanta would get out of that group with Manchester United. So I think they've done really well to get this far. You know, Juventus haven't been great this season. I was wondering, Nicky, if you had any theories as to why they're so low down the table compared to how, you know, the expectations around Juventus. I know they've had a lot of changes in personnel, but I caught the Torino game, actually, and I thought Torino did a decent job and looked quite lively at times. So I was wondering if there's any particular reason why Juve are sort of struggling with Allegri back.
Yeah, I could go off onto a whole tangent about Torino, but I met Max doesn't want me to, so I won't.
Torino don't playing want some you good to. Football. I want no Torino tangents ever.
But Juventus are, across the board, I think when you look at their team, it's just not as good as it used to be. Wojciech Szczesny's been okay as a keeper for them, but he's not Gigi Buffon. Bonucci and Chiellini are both older, older and performing less well than they used to, or at least less consistently. They're injured a lot. De Ligt, I think, has been really good this season at the back, but in general, that defence has declined. Alexandro is a shadow of the player he was a couple of years ago. The midfield has been a real, real mess, partly because of a recruitment policy that seems to have been driven for a while by, who's around on a free transfer, which led to Aaron Ramsey and Rabiot being brought in on big wages and neither of them really working very well. They're trying to fix some of this stuff, they're trying to deal with it. They didn't have a real number nine since Higuain, perhaps, even. And they finally resolved that by bringing in Vlahovic. They brought in Manuel Locatelli this summer to try to provide some of that ability to put a foot on the ball in midfield and have some control again, because since Pjanic left, they haven't really had a regista who can do the job. But I think that is the sort of the simple answer. There's so much more you can put into it. I think Allegri's tactics can be really ponderous. I think he's quite an effective manager in terms of results, but he's a real low tempo manager and it can be eye gougingly boring to watch sometimes. But the reality is this squad is worse than it has been in a while, and it's not where it was. And I think that's the short answer. And I won't go on longer for the sake of Max, who I'm sure wants to not have me sat here talking about Italian football all night.
Well, I would happily listen to you talk about Italian football forever. When I want to do that, I listen to your excellent Italian football podcast, Nicky. On this podcast, I'm going to move on to politics and war, which is not something I like to talk about, but we need to. Jan says, any chance of discussing the impact of Russia's planned war against Ukraine on football, the final in St. Petersburg, Gazprom sponsorships, Chelsea? Barry, you've done some work on this.
Yeah, I was curious to know what the possible implications would be for Chelsea and to a lesser extent Everton if sanctions were taken against Roman Abramovich and Alistair Usmanov. Usmanov obviously has close ties with Everton but isn't a stakeholder at the moment. But Roman Abramovich obviously owns Chelsea. Now, yesterday, Boris Johnson, our Prime Minister, announced he'd impose sanctions on 3 individual oligarchs and 5 sort of small banks, and they've been sort of laughed out of the Commons as a very token gesture against Putin and the Russians. He was asked why he hadn't imposed sanctions on Roman Abramovich, and he said that Chelsea's owner is already subject to them. And like many things Boris Johnson says in the House of Commons, this is demonstrably not true. Unusually, he has agreed to correct the parliamentary record and has admitted he was wrong. That's not something that doesn't happen very often. This is obviously all on the back of Putin's troops moving into Donetsk and Luhansk. He says they're there for peacekeeping reasons. Others don't necessarily agree. Now, it's important to state from the get-go, I suppose, that Roman Abramovich insists that he does not have close ties with Vladimir Putin, and he has in the past successfully sued people who say otherwise. So I'm not going to say otherwise, even though I've just said the word otherwise. Anyway, yesterday in the House of Commons, Lib Dem Foreign Affairs spokesman Leila Morin used her parliamentary privilege to name 33 Russian oligarchs who she thinks have close links with Vladimir Putin to say they should be subject to sanctions. And Roman Abramovich was first on that list. Alistair Usmanov was also on the list. But it's widely believed that Johnson has zero intention of sanctioning any of these lads. If he did, the whole Tory edifice would crumble and fall. Alistair Campbell, among others, cynic, cynical people has also suggested that Putin might have compromat on Boris Johnson, who's known to attend lavish parties in Italy with his friend Evgeny Lebedev, who owns the Evening Standard. And other cynical people have suggested that the sanctions Boris has imposed are so weak because he's giving other oligarchs, more important, powerful oligarchs with ties to the Tory party, giving them time to move cash and liquidate their assets. But again, I couldn't possibly say whether this is true or not. But the upshot is, if Roman Abramovich was to be subjected to sanctions, that would probably entail his assets being frozen. Whether or not this would have an effect on Chelsea Football Club, it's unlikely. They're kind of self-sufficient now because they make millions and millions, tens, hundreds of millions of pounds selling fringe players, reserve players. So they'd manage, probably be able to pootle along regardless. But it is an interesting one. It will be interesting to see what happens. At the moment as well, it looks extremely unlikely that UEFA will be able to stage the Champions League final in St. Petersburg. So that'll probably have to be moved. And what was the other thing? Oh, the Gazprom thing. I'm afraid I don't really know. But, you know, it is, if you watch a Champions League match, there are Gazprom advertising hoardings everywhere. There's Road to St. Petersburg logos everywhere. That's kind of going to get a bit embarrassing for UEFA in the very near future.
Insert some joke about Roman Abramovich's assets being frozen and Romelu Lukaku not really moving around the pitch. I imagine him taking it very, very literally. UEFA statement says UEFA is constantly and closely monitoring the situation. The governing body said, at present, there are no plans to change the venue. The UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson says there is no chance Russia will be allowed to host major football tournaments as a result of its decision to, quote, invade a sovereign country. And he also said, as you said, Barry, here, a spokesman for Boris Johnson said he misspoke when he claimed Chelsea Football Club's Russian owner Roman Abramovich faced sanctions. The Prime Minister's official spokesman said the PM would correct the record. Right, that'll do for part two. Part three, Ewan Murray will join us and we'll do a Fitbar Corner. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Jim says, please can we get some more smooth jazz pumped in for Fitbar Corner? Why not, eh? Ewan Murray joins us. Hello, mate.
Morning. Good to be back so swiftly.
Yeah, it's always nice to have you, Ewan. Look, there's lots happening. The title race, the club's respective European adventures. Can we start with that Rangers win in Dortmund in the Europa League 4-2? Because it felt like quite a historic result. Is that going too far or is that accurate?
No, I think that's fair. I was in Dortmund last week. Rangers were terrific. Fully deserved their win. Probably could and should have won by more, actually. But the kind of historic significance is tricky, right? Because it's the first leg of a tie. Rangers could well lose. And it's no slight on Rangers. Dortmund, if they get their act together, are a very good team. Rangers could lose the tie. And then where does the first leg actually sit? I mean, I don't know. It's tricky. I mean, it felt like it was certainly worthy of, I said in the match report, inclusion in the kind of, you know, pantheon of one-off Scottish results in Europe. But that's, for now, that's all it is, because Dortmund could turn it around and then it becomes a bit messy. But listen, full credit to Rangers, they were fantastic. Dortmund's defending for a team of that level is as bad as I can recall seeing. But we shouldn't take away from Rangers because they weren't expected to go there and score four goals. They did it. Could and should have scored more and fully deserved their win.
Can you, obviously I know, but can you educate listeners on what's in the pantheon of great one-off European results for Scottish teams? Is this what Aberdeen in the 80s and Dundee United, those kind of things?
Yeah, Dundee United beating Barcelona, Celtic won the European Cup, Rangers winning the Cup Winners' Cup, Aberdeen, you know, won a European trophy. I always get Aberdeen one mixed up. That was a Cup Winners' Cup as well, I'm pretty sure. There's more than you may think, Max. That was slightly patronising in tone.
Oh, no. We have been accused of being patronising with Fitbar Corner, which is why we brought you here, Ewan, to, you know, because I don't know who normally does it, but he often gets accused What I was trying to do was trying to get some perspective of what this. I totally take your point. It's one leg. If they lose, what does it actually mean? But it just felt, because it was away from home, especially, and to score four goals, and with the quality that Dortmund have, especially up front, it just felt really special for Rangers.
No, 100%. And it was, as I say, it was the fact they deserved it and played so well. And actually, to their full credit, they went for Dortmund. They didn't sit back and think, oh, this is a team with a great reputation. We better be careful. They didn't. Rangers thought, this is a vulnerable team. We were going to go for them. And they pulled that off exceptionally well. With the caveat, and far be it from me as ever to be downbeat, but with the caveat that there's still 90 minutes to go, and if Erling Haaland is back and playing, as we will know later today, it could be a different ballgame. But time will tell.
And on the same night, Celtic, who are flying and are doing so well in the league, sort of have this humiliating result against Bodo Glimt, who played absolutely brilliantly.
Yeah, I didn't see that game. I was in Germany and I was travelling back at the time, between Dortmund and Cologne, actually, as that game was going on. You say humiliating, but Bodo Glimt have got a pretty decent record in Europe recently. I think they hammered Roma 6-1.
Yeah, they did. Fair.
What's strange is that they had a look, their home results tend to be far better than their away results, but they seem to have a team. They've obviously got an exceptionally good coach. It's a shame Lars isn't on here to wax lyrical, but they've obviously got a very good coach. They have lost a few players, but have retained a group of players who can. Listen, they're not a top team in Europe, but I don't think they're complete no marks. I'm not sure it's a humiliation for Celtic. It was a poor result and unexpected result given how well they're playing domestically, but I think Bodo Glimt have got something going for them at this present moment, and their European results would seem to kind of endorse that.
I think it is patronising, actually, to say it's a humiliation for Celtic, because they...
All right.
Yeah, sorry, Max.
Well, no, I'll just say before, let me put my case before you, is that, you know, Bodo Glimt's season hasn't started. They're in pre-season. They've lost loads of players. They played a right back. They played someone at left back who'd never played left back in his entire career and only played right back in the second tier of Norwegian football. I mean, very much quoting Lars, who I watched the game with. But in those senses, I fully expected Celtic to win. Maybe humiliation is taking it too far. Anyway, Barry, the case for the defence has rested.
I can talk about Glimt if you want, by the way, but I don't know if you...
Yes, Jonathan. Well, okay. Let's go to Barry first to tell me why I'm wrong, and then we'll go to Jonathan.
Well, I think it's because it was Bodo Glimt who, because they have a slightly amusing name for us and nobody knows much about them, everyone assumes Celtic should have beaten them. But their results, you know, in the Europa League have been good. And, you know, people are saying, oh, Celtic are humiliated by this bleak European outpost from the middle of nowhere. Whereas, you know, Celtic are kind of similar. in that regard.
Jonathan.
No, I can wholeheartedly back that was not an embarrassing result, really. Glimt are a really, really good side. They're the real deal under their manager, Kjetil Knutsen. They've been unbelievable for the last two seasons in Norway. Nearly went the whole season unbeaten, scored 100 goals in a 30-game season the year before last. Back-to-back champions for the first time in their history, obviously winning the league. And Knutsen, I'm really surprised that he hasn't got a bigger job, to be honest, because I think he was linked with the Norwich job when Daniel Farke left. But there was reports that he didn't want to go because he wanted his whole coaching team and that kind of thing. But yeah, just to interject and say, Knutsen's a top, top manager. And it wouldn't be surprising to me if they go really deep in the competition, to be honest. They're a really good team.
So if someone could just cut in the word, I don't know, Celtic beaten by a good Bodo Glimt in a very tough draw. If you could just put that in about 10 minutes ago, it'd be very useful. Let's talk about the title race, Ewan. So Celtic, 7 straight league wins, a hat-trick for Jack O'Makis, who looks like a wonderful player. And it all seems silly to ask you every time, who are the favourites? Because it could keep changing. But you get the impression that it's going to go down to the wire, and it is really interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, Celtic are the firm favourites as we sit here now. Celtic have all the momentum. I mean, Rangers go to Dortmund and were as good as I explained there, and then they come back and draw at Dundee United, where they should have won, to be fair. They completely battered United for the last half hour of the game but couldn't get the winning goal. And that's a problem for Rangers because they've dropped points elsewhere, Ross County, Aberdeen, and Celtic are in this run. You know, I say it every time I'm on, but I think the general standard of the Scottish League this season even by Scottish standards, is pretty poor. So I think for Celtic and Rangers to drop points against the other teams, more so Rangers because they were so dominant last season, for Rangers to be dropping points against the other teams isn't really acceptable. Now, Celtic, you know, they just got past Dundee at the weekend 3-2, but the fact is they did it. It just feels like momentum is on their side. And Rangers are wobbling and can't afford any more wobbles because, as I said, given that I don't think many of the other teams are going to cause them many problems, if that gap, you know, it's now 3 points and Celtic's goal difference is way better, if that gap becomes any or much bigger, I think Rangers have got a big, big challenge in their hands. And it, listen, full credit to Postecoglou, I say it, said it after the Old Firm game, but the scale with which he's turned it around at Celtic is beyond, I think, even their own supporters' wildest expectations. It's been quite something to watch.
We talked quite a lot about Postecoglou. We haven't really talked about Van Bronckhorst. What impact has he had? How's he getting along?
Well, that's a strange one. I mean, when he came in, they had a string of very good performances, played very well. There was a sense that maybe under Gerrard, they're kind of running out of steam a little bit and the change might be a good thing for Rangers. But they've really hit the skids since. And it's hard to say that Van Bronckhorst has overseen improvement. Well, you can't say that. I mean, they were 6 points ahead on Boxing Day. And as I said, now find themselves 3 points and I think 9 goals behind. So, put it this way, I'm conscious there's a long way to go, but if Rangers don't win this title, having been 25 points clear in May when they won the last league, given Celtic's overhaul, that's a huge regression by Rangers. There are signs of regression already, but if they don't win this league from the position they were in, I think there are huge questions to be asked about the football management and the football department at Rangers, because that would be an incredible turnaround.
Ewan, I don't know if this is a boring question because I know he's barely played and inevitably is injured because that seems to have been the last part of his career, but just wondered how Aaron Ramsey's looked since he got there to Rangers.
Yeah, well, it's not a boring question at all. It's very interesting. He played against Annan Athletic in the Scottish Cup. I'll be honest, I didn't watch that game because I've got far better things to do than watch Annan playing Rangers on a Saturday evening. But that's been it, and I think this was the worry, Nicky. Right, when he comes in, how much is he going to influence the game? How much is he going to influence the title race if he's not? Firstly, he can't be sharp enough to play. I think the last 90 minutes he played was October, and then he picked up a knock and wasn't in the squad for the weekend game at Dundee United. And this would be for all the razzmatazz and Rangers and Celtic, to be fair, but Rangers, I think, especially like statement signings. They like players of, you know, stature because they think it adds to the allure of their club. But if they're not going to play, and Ramsey's, you know, related to believe costing quite a lot of money between now and the end of the season, you have to question how valid for Rangers this is going to be. So they have to try and get him in a team pretty quickly, I would say. It seems, Nicky, like Juventus were pretty keen to get him out the door. Is that a fair comment?
I think they've been pretty eager to get him out the door for a while because he doesn't play, and that's this unfortunate thing, because in my mind, it's almost like shocking now that he's still 31 years old. It feels like he should be older because he's sort of been in what feels like the tail end of his career for a long time at Juventus. And he's not. He's not an old footballer yet. And he just wasn't playing because he wasn't fit. So it's not encouraging that he's still not been able to play much so far at Rangers.
Richard says, can fit by corner be entirely about Hart's chances of finishing third, please?
Not as strong as they were a few weeks ago. They're still 9 points clear. This goes back to my bemoaning the weakness of the league. But Hearts are not playing very well just now. They're in a bit of a rut. So I'm not as confident about that as I was a few weeks ago. They're in the quarterfinals of the Cup. They're 9 points clear and third in the league. I would have taken this, given where my allegiances are, I would have taken this in July and August. But they're in a bit of a hole when it comes to form at the minute.
And James says, the potential for part-time Arbroath getting promoted to the Scottish Premiership. And since you can't be bothered to watch Annan Athletic against Rangers, I don't know if you can be bothered to watch Arbroath.
I have watched a bit of Arbroath. I still think Kilmarnock will win that division and Arbroath will be in the playoffs and therefore at least have a chance of getting promoted to the Premier League. What Arbroath have done is they've got the best part-time players in the country. Now, there's a lot of players in Scotland who, for them, it's better to play part-time football and have another job rather than be a full-time football player in the second tier where you wouldn't earn as much money and have as many career prospects, right? Does that make sense? So what Arbroath have done is they've mastered that kind of market where they have the very, very good part-time players who want to stay at that level. They've had some good loanees from top-flight clubs. They've got the charismatic manager in Dick Campbell, who everyone likes to talk about and enjoys his stories. And they play in this rickety, old-fashioned ground, you know, on the edge of the ocean, which is permanently windswept. You know, it's a nice story. But I think ultimately Kilmarnock, with Kyle Lafferty up front and Derek McInnes as the manager, I think they will win that league. But are both at least have a chance of playing in the top flight next season.
Ewan, is there anything else pressing in the world of Fitbar?
No, a couple of managerial changes. Stephen Robinson has come back to manage St Mirren. Mark McGee, controversially, given he last managed Eastbourne Borough, has come back to manage Dundee.
I've seen you tweeting not wholly supportive of that one.
Well, not Mark. I like Mark McGee. Mark McGee is fantastic company. If you ever have a chance to be in his company, he's a terrific storyteller. But I am dubious about the means by which he would end up at Dundee, given he hasn't managed in Scotland for years. As I said, he last managed the Eastbourne Borough. I don't think it says much when you go from there to the Scottish top flight. And lo and behold, his best mate, Gordon Strachan, just happens to be the director of football, technical director, sorry, at Dundee. So were I a Dundee supporter, I would not be entirely encouraged by that appointment. As I say, nothing against Mark McGee, who I've got a lot of time for. It's the circumstances around it.
Maybe what Dundee's players need, Ewan, is someone to tell them some cracking stories before they go out to face opposition teams.
Maybe. He's the two best Mark McGee stories I can't tell on here. They're not appropriate, but I promise you they're exceptionally funny. I'm sorry, I've let the side down with that, but he as I say, my disquiet against Dundee's appointment is nothing personally at all against Mark McGee. I can vouch for him being great company. And previously, but we're going back 20 years when he was in England, he was a very good football manager, but that's a long time ago.
Am I right in thinking, Ewan, he has an 8-game ban hanging over him or something? Is that him?
Six game ban. That's the other, the appointed manager who has a 6-game touchline ban, one of them obviously used. So not only can he not be on the touchline during the game, which I think has to have an influence, but he can't be in the dressing room 75 minutes before kickoff or 50 minutes after full time. That doesn't matter, but he can't be around the team, close to the team for all that time. And I would argue in their relegation threatened position, that could be quite important, but that wasn't deemed significant. So
he could record the stories as a voice note and then just they could play them out in the WhatsApp group before kickoff.
He could.
Hey, Ewan, thanks so much for coming. I enjoyed this one.
Thanks for having me.
I mean, I enjoy all of them. It's clear to point that out. Thanks, Ewan. Ewan Murray, the Guardian Scottish football correspondent. Matt says, is your chips going to be the next thing we shout at goalies? Has anybody else seen this Arsenal? Arsenal do these videos really well where they promote sort of the local cafes and restaurants around the Emirates. And this one is Aaron Ramsdale ordering some chips and then everybody going, ooh, and then it cuts to different people and then David Seaman comes out and goes, ooh, and then he just hulls the chips aloft like he's won the World Cup and they all go, your chips, And it is really like, it's very rare that a football team makes good social media content and I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, it's brilliant. And it's a commendable initiative by Arsenal to promote local businesses around the Emirates, but it's just genuinely funny. And these things can be very tin-eared or naff, often are, but they've really nailed this.
They have. Let's finish with our producer Joel, who was at Charlton 0 MK Dons 2 yesterday and tweeted this, which I very much enjoyed. How bad is it at Charlton tonight? The person in front of me is sorting out their VAT. And you can that it says on the... He's taken a photo of the iPhone. You must read the following before making a claim. Of the extra expenses of working from home because of the coronavirus, COVID-19, you can claim and get tax relief and expenses of £6 a week.
Oh, it's for energy bills.
Is it for energy bills? There you are. So he's not doing his VAT, but he was so bored. he was looking at how to get tax relief.
And he's also doing his returns far too late. Should have been in on the 31st of December.
Absolutely right.
Or is it January?
It's all right.
January.
I think it's January. Yeah. Who knows? Maybe he got an extension. You know, maybe like he didn't get his essay in on time.
I believe HMRC are taking a more lenient approach at this year because of the pandemic.
Excellent news. Well, you know, if you can't do it at the Valley, where can you do it? But look, that'll do for today's podcast. Barry, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Nikki.
Thanks.
Cheers, Jonathan.
Thank you, Max.
Plenty of Champions League and Premier League football for us tomorrow. Oh, the Guardian Football Weekly was produced by Joel Grove. It was forgotten. Danielle Stevens is our exec producer today. So thank you, Danielle. Please don't ring me up at 3 a.m. because I've got to re-record something. You know, I'm happy to keep in the humiliation and the bit of the intro. I'm happy to keep them in. Just don't call me. We'll be back tomorrow.
This is The Guardian.